On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. George Bush says there is no change in his determination to win, but all around the Iraq war now is talk of change. As Baghdad bleeds and U.S. military leaders concede they have not been able to stop the bleeding, the definition of victory is getting a makeover. Iraq as model democracy for the Mideast is little mentioned. Iraq's very unity is in play. The president's open-ended commitment may get an end point. Last week, the Tet Offensive label was slapped on Iraq's bloodletting. Up next on Point, we'll test that analogy with famed Vietnam War correspondent David Halberstam and look ahead at Iraq with New York Times Baghdad Bureau Chief John Burns. First, from Baghdad, with the latest news, I'm joined by Los Angeles Times correspondent Louise Rowe. Louise, thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, Tom.
Give us the latest death tolls over the weekend. They sound bad. 7 U.S. soldiers. Is that still where it stands? And what about Iraqis?
Well, we had, just yesterday, we had 6 U.S. troops killed all within an hour here in Baghdad. So a real push by the militants to attack American troops here. We had at least 44 Iraqis killed in various fightings and bombings across the country, bombings targeting shoppers, buying sweets to for the celebration here, and marking the end of Ramadan, the Muslim holy month.
What are U.S. authorities saying about the U.S., the level of U.S. casualties? It's headed for maybe a record, already as high as since 2004. Is this inevitable with the effort in Baghdad to staunch the violence there, which they say is not working?
Well, what the U.S. officials here are saying is that the high death toll is in part a function of increased patrols. Now, we have seen American troops more on the streets of Baghdad as part of this operation Together Forward than much touted. Well, the plan to secure Baghdad that was first much touted, and then later, now we had Major General Caldwell, recently saying that they were going to go back and look at that plan again because it may not be working.
Louise, there's a sense in Washington, in the U.S. these days, that change has to come somehow and fairly soon. Do you feel that in Baghdad, among government officials, on the streets?
Well, certainly, things have gotten progressively worse. We have more people killed now than ever before. The problem is the Maliki-led government, Prime Minister Nouri Maliki, seems fairly weak and inefficient in dealing with both the militants and the various death squads. It's hard to see how this can be solved.
And the U.S. military has also said that they must have the Iraqi security forces, the army in particular, stepping up for this Baghdad effort to be successful. Is there any sign that more Iraqi troops may be on the way? Many who were called did not show up. Is there any sign that may change?
Well, again, it's hard to see why or how that would change. We've seen Iraqi security forces refusing to fight. The Iraqi security forces are dominated by Shia, and in certain cases, they've been unwilling to fight other Shia. Now we also have inter-Shia fighting, most recently in Samarra, where Shia militiamen affiliated with Muqtada al-Sadr basically fought other Shias who dominate the police force there in very, very bloody street battles, and eventually Muqtada al-Sadr's militiamen leveled several police stations, simply blowing them up. So there's a lot of problems here of various kinds, and it's just hard to see how they're going to be solved.
A tremendous range of problems. Louise Rowe with the LA Times in Baghdad, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Joining me now from New York is David Halberstam. He's best known for his coverage of the war in Vietnam. In fact, at the age of 30, he won a Pulitzer Prize for that coverage. His book, The Best and the Brightest, is still regarded as among the best chronicles of the Vietnam War and the thinking of the leaders who made it.
What better authority may be to look at the comparisons now being made between Vietnam's Tet Offensive in 1968 and the current situation in Iraq? David Halberstam, thanks very much for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
What do you make of the comparisons? Tom Friedman threw it out there last week in print. Of course, it had been floating around for a while as things have gotten worse and worse in Iraq. You were in Vietnam. You're looking at Iraq. Is this a fair comparison? Is it a useful comparison?
I think it's very tricky to use. Tom is a friend of mine. He's obviously a very distinguished journalist. He's a, you know, they got the Pulitzer as a hat trick, I think, three times. But I thought it was rather, having said that, a careless reference, because it was just one quick reference in a whole column to Tet, and it seemed to imply, the way he wrote it, that Tet, you know, Tet was pumped up by the media and really was not a military defeat, that militarily the VC and the NVA lost, and I gather the president has agreed with that. I mean, again, the phrasing on everybody's part is very soft. No one's really defined what they mean by Tet, and I think Tet was an enormous benchline and a reflection of failure, and the whole country, our country, realizing that it didn't work. And the people on the right who seize on Tet like to say it was a political defeat, but a military victory. For us. And in a political war, which Vietnam was, and certainly Iraq is, there is no such thing. You cannot have a military victory that is a political defeat. Everything is political. And up to Tet, the United States government, Rostow and Johnson and people like that, had been saying, in effect, the other side is about to fall out of the trees, they're almost ready to surrender, our power is working, when in fact that was not true, that our journalism, in fact, if anything, underestimated their strength, their durability, their resilience, their ability to keep coming, the fact that they controlled the rate of the war and that all we could do was tax them. The journalists in Vietnam, it's very interesting. We were all, when you need a scapegoat, when a war doesn't work, you blame the journalists. And we were blamed for not covering enough American victories. Our sins were really, I think, greater. In fact, we covered American victories, and because we could go where our technology went, our troops went. Where we were weaker was covering the political strength of the other side, the ability to keep recruiting, to keep sending young men down the trails, the dynamic that went back to the French Indochina War and meant that they would always keep coming. We could not get that on film in television, and therefore, if anything, our coverage underestimated the resilience, the dynamic of the other side, and Tet, therefore, was a shock to Washington.
So you're not signing on to the shorthand kind of reiteration of what Tet was in this conversation today, but Tet was a watershed moment, it appeared, in the American public's understanding of that war and thereby the political embrace or lack.
Well, that's what you see. I mean, what is if George Stephanopoulos interviews George Bush, the president, and George Bush, the president, makes the case, sort of agrees with the parallel of Tet, is he agreeing with my rather somber view of Tet as an alarm clock for the American society that we are caught in an unwinnable war that is open-ended and eventually we have to go home and the other side is going to win? I mean, is he agreeing with that? I don't think so. I think that it was a huge chill to the people who were pro-war. It drove Lyndon Johnson out of office. What it really said was, what we're doing doesn't work.
So now we have Secretary of Defense today, Donald Rumsfeld, saying we cannot be defeated militarily in Iraq.
I've heard that before. I mean, the word military is a very militarily. Yes, that's right. We are so militarily strong that they can't technically defeat us because we have so much power. But if we can't win, if we are draining ourselves, sending young men, if politically what we want to happen, a good Iraq arising out of these embers, I don't think that can happen. I think it drains us. I think it humiliates us in front of the entire Arab world. I think historically people may look back in 40 years and see the most important thing of this historically is that every night in the Arab world, on Arab television, with Arab filmmakers, with Arab newscasters and Arab spin, there's going to be shots of the frustrations of this war, the fact that we're not able to do it, of the collateral damage, and we are going to end up doing their recruiting, the other side's recruiting for them, and that we are creating a dynamic that is going to polarize that part of the world against us, not just those who were always sworn to be our enemies, but a great many of people on the sidelines. I think we are doing our children and our grandchildren a great deal of damage. And I think this may be the secret historical part of the equation.
And what about on the home front? Tet helped turn America against the Vietnam War. The polls are not good on the Iraq War. How do you see that moment? Is the president losing? Has he lost the American people?
The Democrats are a very weak party at this point. They're fragmented and they're not centered. The seemingly leading candidate for the presidency, Mrs. Clinton, Senator Clinton, has tried to play this one on both sides as if the real issue of Iraq is that we didn't send enough troops. I think that the Democrats, they're going to get some benefit, but it's not like they're a clear party with a clearly defined, opposition position.
So where does that leave the country on change? Baker's talking about change. Republicans?
I think it's like Vietnam. I think it's one of those situations. I can remember John Kenneth Galbraith telling me in 1967 as the protest in the city, in the country mounted, particularly in the upper middle class starting on the candidates, on the campuses, that this was a time when the people of the country were ahead of the politicians. And I think that's happening now. I think there's a general sense that this cannot be done, cannot be won in any acceptable framework. It isn't to talk this way isn't to say that Saddam is a decent human being or anything like that. It's just, I think, a miscalculation of the effectiveness of American force, a sense that there are other priorities. When they were thinking of going in the Bush people, I was always opposed and said on programs like this that I thought that we were going to punch our fist into the largest hornet's nest in the world. And I think that's happened. I thought that we would very quickly run into an urban insurgency. And I now notice that people like me are being once again accused of cutting and running. And I think what I'd prefer is to sort of cut and walk, simply because it doesn't work and because it's other people's children.
What about the argument that Iraq is not like Vietnam in that it may be much more dangerous to walk away from this one?
It's much more dangerous. There's no doubt about it. There's no doubt. Vietnam, when we left, they would have strewn our way with flowers. Flowers all the way. There was no additional, for all the talk of dominoes, it was always indigenous nationalism, whereas this is a regional thing. It spreads through the whole region at a time where Islam is a fire. No, there's a payback on this, and it's going to be ugly, but the alternative is to keep doing something that does not work. This one's much meaner, much harder, and we're going to pay a higher price. But the real question, and the awful thing is the eventual winner there, in the long run, is going to be Iran, a far more dangerous country. What this administration did was take the one regional opponent to Iran, a very unlikable country. Let's assume that Iran, with the theological leadership, is very unlikable by our perceptions, and so was Iraq. But there was a counterforce. What we have done is weakened and destroyed the counterforce and made Iran almost surely the winner. One of the most interesting things that's happened in this is that the Iraqis that are the beneficiaries of our incursion, who are our Iraqis, have lined up with Hezbollah in the Israeli fighting in Lebanon.
So hello, take a look at that. We're talking with David Halberstam. His latest book is The Education of a Coach, but he was right in the thick of Vietnam for many years. Rich is calling from Arnold, Maryland. Hi, Rich. You're on the air with David Halberstam.
Good morning, David.
Good morning.
All right. I want to go back a little bit real quickly on this. This stuff always goes back to 1953. It goes back to the when the CIA stepped into Iran and removed the duly elected leader and put the Shah in position. Since then, we've been just following this whole thing of all the stuff was oil. All it's been about is oil. I'm agreeing with most of what you said. I think it's gone. We cannot win it. We need to set a timetable and get out of it. I am a Democrat, and I'm disgusted with the Democratic Party. I think it's just nonsense. But what I'm concerned about, if this thing dissolves into what we think we have now is civil war, what's going to happen with Turkey and the Kurds? That's what I want to know. I think Turkey, we're talking a lot about Iran, but what happens if Turkey decides that they don't like what's going on, they take advantage, and they decide to move in and to displace the Kurds?
Rich, thanks for calling with that. David, Turkey and the Kurds, and behind that, Rich points at oil.
I think you can sort of protect the Kurds. That's always been an indigenous force that is very good at protecting itself. And I think when you have an ethnic clean line, you can protect people. I think what your problem is when it seeps over and becomes a political thing and you can't separate the person who is supposed to be your ally. I think we can protect the Kurds. We've done it in the past. I think there's a complex relationship, obviously, between the Kurds and the Turks, but it seems to me that that's the job of skilled people in Washington to balance out forces. That's what they're paid to do. Turkey really wants to be more a part of Europe, and there are things that we can do to sort of keep them, I would think, in some kind of connection with us. I mean, I think that's the kind of geopolitical problem and dilemma that we pay a lot of money to the people in Washington to get right, and it's not an undoable thing. I mean, there are things in both their interests that should keep them in a relationship, however uneasy, that falls short of war.
But Rich says set a timetable. Perhaps the Bush administration itself will go for that soon. Rich suggests if it doesn't work, get out of there. You know, the dominoes didn't fall in Southeast Asia, but here, if dominoes fall, there's America's energy supply sitting right underneath it. So can we set a timetable and walk away from this?
I don't know about setting timetables. In terms of energy supplies, they have to sell the energy. The energy is, you know, not valuable if it's not sold. I mean, one of the terrible things about this particular administration, all administrations, for the last 30 years, the only president who really worked on this was Jimmy Carter. We should have been seeing the kind of threat from the Cold War, the Soviets switching to the Middle East, to a kind of Islamifier, and we should have been more and more people wanting energy, and we should have been disciplining ourselves rather than letting the Arabs discipline us. The shocking moment was that on September 12th, the president did not act to come with new draconian taxes on energy. I mean, that in a way, if you're going to say we're in a state of war in this part of the world, the first thing is to tax us on energy and move into a new era. And we haven't done that, and it's time to do it, because it's become an instrument of war. And as for, you know, I was at a Phi Beta Kappa Sirius ceremony at Harvard a year ago. I got 50 years after college initiated into Phi Beta Kappa. Our speaker was John Deutsch, former head of the CIA. Mm-hmm. John Deutsch is a very tough, blunt guy, and he's very privy to all the intelligence. He said, get out. Get out now. It doesn't work, so get out. It isn't going to be pretty getting out, but it isn't going to be pretty staying, and it isn't going to work. And the longer it goes on and it doesn't work, the more you damage yourself in the region. Yep. And I agree with him.
A final question. You wrote about the road into Vietnam in The Best and Brightest. We all know that since then, Americans have studied that war. The U.S. military studied that war. The U.S. military was committed never to have that happen again.
Never
and yet, here we are. It's not Vietnam, it's Iraq. But we're back in a situation where it's darn tough and political support is falling away. You can see it in the polls. How did we get back here? Where's the learning here?
Well, I think the key thing was that two things. One, the vice president, I think, Colin, the force against going into an adventure like this in the 30 years since Vietnam was a combination of the United States Army and the State Department jointly with their feet on the brake at the small staff meetings. What happened was Rumsfeld just trumped the Army, turned Tommy Franks into sort of a kind of puppet, cutting every time, cutting the force levels, as Powell was able to get around 600,000 for Iraq War I. I think Franks got, what, 150,000? That was one thing. The army was taken out of the play, and meanwhile there was a new player at the inner poker game where they made the decision, and that was a new powerful office of the Vice President of the United States, Dick Cheney, who had salted the entire high apparatus of national security with his own people, and therefore people like the United States Army and Colin Powell at State Department, who thought they were big, crucial players and important players in Bush 1, were taken out of the play. These people were the two things. One, they were ideological about what was going to happen, and both of them, Cheney and Rumsfeld, I think, post-Cold War, what I would call triumphalists. They think because the Soviet Union is gone, which it is, we are more powerful, which is true, we are, except that power is not applicable in places like the Middle East or Vietnam.
Think or thought. David Halberstam covered Vietnam, wrote The Best and Brightest. His new book is The Education of a Coach. We're delighted to have you with us today. David Halberstam, thanks very much for being here.
Nice to be with you.
We're going to turn in just a moment to Baghdad and New York Times Baghdad Bureau Chief John Burns. But first, let's get the current view of President Bush in our ear. Hear it from a pre-taped interview with President George Bush. It aired yesterday on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos. He spoke about what determines success or failure in Iraq.
I define success or failure as to whether or not the Iraqis will be able to defend themselves. I define success or failure as whether the unity government is making difficult decisions necessary to unite the country. I define success or failure as whether schools are being built or hospitals are being opened. I define success or failure as whether we're seeing a democracy, you know, grow in the heart of the Middle East. Because a democracy in the Middle East, a society based upon a liberty will be a defeat for the terrorists.
President Bush, in an interview aired yesterday with George Stephanopoulos, we're joined now from Baghdad by John Burns, Baghdad Bureau Chief of the New York Times. John Burns, thank you very much for joining us. The president says a democracy in the Middle East based on liberty is still what he's gunning for. Is it out there for the U.S.? Is it out there for Iraq?
It's difficult to see here, talking to officials in the U.S. military command and to American civil officials, that democracy is still quite as intensively sought after an objective as it was. I'm trying to state this carefully. I don't think it's been abandoned, but I think that it's very much at the moment second best to the achievement of some kind of stability, and the, if you will, the kind of project that the United States began with here under Jerry Bremer in 2003-2004, when, if I recall right, something between $750 million of American taxpayers' money was dedicated, and that was out of the $18 billion or so voted by Congress in November of 2003, was dedicated to the construction of democracy. Much of that has been set aside now. We don't see any more democracy training centers. Women's centers that were opened, many of them are closed or hardly functioning. I think all the effort now is being bent to creating stability.
John, the Tet Offensive reference that your colleague columnist Tom Friedman made has brought to mind kind of images of free fall, and the numbers have certainly been lousy out of Iraq and Baghdad recently, both for Iraqi deaths and American troop deaths. What's your characterization of where the conflict stands now? Is it in a kind of meltdown state, a new state of free fall, or is this just more grinding and it's a more a political sense that this is getting to be too much?
Well, I think, a note of caution needs to be entered here. As long as the United States has 140,000 troops here, with, of course, its coalition partners, and an Iraqi military, which is stated to be at its maximum something in the nature of Iraqi security forces of over 300,000, probably only about half that number effective. The real center of authority and power here rests with the Iraqi government and the United States Armed Forces. They can prevent, I think, a slide into complete disaster. I'm not sure they can do much more than that. But they do, for example, let's look at Baghdad. Mm. It's true that civilian casualties in Baghdad are at the worst level probably of the war. American military casualties too. But nonetheless, if you drive around Baghdad, today's not a good example because the Eid holiday has just begun here. Mm. So the streets, that's the end of Ramadan. The streets are pretty empty. But Baghdad is still a pretty busy city. Now, that's not to say that lives of Iraqis are not seriously, in some cases, critically, disastrously impacted by this. But I think we have to be careful not to present a situation, a picture of a complete meltdown. It's extremely bad. It seems to be getting worse, but it's not absolutely catastrophic.
Let's get a call from Charleston, South Carolina. William, you're on the air with John Burns in Baghdad.
Hi, Mr. Burns.
Yes, how are you?
Fine. Listen, I remember, Mr. Burns, that you believed, as did the neocons, that just before the invasion of Iraq, that the people would in fact welcome the liberation of their country from Saddam and his brutish regime. You know, no longer accept the violence and the inscrutable insurgency, of course, that has now popped up its ugly head, was not foreseen by the neocons nor by you, as I recall your previous conversation.
What's your question, William?
Well, my point being is that, you know, are we now, based upon your past discussion, talking about something like us becoming a Tito who sits upon the location, the people, and keeps it from devolving into a free fall?
Let us pick that up. The break is coming, John Burns. You said as long as that U.S. power sits there, it won't completely fall apart. So does that mean U.S. power has to sit there for how long?
Well, that's a problem. Let me answer a part of what what your caller said about me personally and about the neocons. First of all, I am not a neoconservative. It's not my business to take any part in American politics. But I would like to address the question of whether or not the overthrow of Saddam was welcomed by the Iraqi people. Of course it was, and it still is. If you talk to many Iraqis, they will still say that they are grateful to the United States and its allies for having done that. Of course people did not project the kind of disorder that has followed. That would have been extremely difficult to project. But all the same, if you ask me and others who felt that the repression of Saddam was intolerable, do we apologize for that? I personally do not apologize for that. I was not a promoter of this war. That, again, is not my business to be. I simply describe what I saw.
We've been joined from Baghdad by John Burns, Baghdad bureau chief for the New York Times. We're joined as well now from Washington by Michelle Flournoy, senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, former professor at the National Strategic at the National Defense University. 93 to 98, she was principal deputy assistant secretary of defense for strategy and threat reduction. Michelle Flournoy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Let me get a call right here. Renata in Sudbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Renata. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm going to try and say this without getting too upset.
Okay.
We got a call last night about my nephew who was in Baghdad, who was hit by a roadside bomb. He's 18 years old, and he's brilliant and lovely and kind and thinks there's no higher calling than to serve his country.
What's his name, Renata?
I don't want to say it on the air. I'd like to protect the privacy of my sister and her family at this time.
How badly was he injured?
We don't know. We're waiting for a call, but his best friend, who was on foot patrol with him, was critically injured. And I am against the president, and I have been since we went in. And I don't think Saddam was a great guy, and someone should have taken care of him. But at this point, I was against it when other people's children were going over there and getting hurt and injured and dying. And I'm still against it, and I just want people to vote their conscience and to get involved in politics. And war is rarely the right answer.
Renata, we'll pray for your nephew and hope that he survives and survives well. But in policy terms, what now?
You know, I think we say to the Iraqis, here's what we can give you at this point. I don't know. God help them. But we need to get out. It was a mistake. And whoever is the president next needs to say, this was a mistake, and I'm sorry, and we'll help you the best we can. But, you know, George Bush's mistake, we can't be paying for this the rest of our life. He made a mistake, and he needs to be man enough to say, I made a mistake.
So much and no more. Renata, our heartfelt best wishes for your nephew and hope that he's well and recovers soon. Thank you for calling. John Burns, there's the voice of American loss from this end of the telephone line. You know, the polls are not showing a lot of support for the war out there. Is the U.S. military in Baghdad feeling that? Are they fearful of that loss of support?
I want to say first that that call, I have to say, is probably a more powerful thing than I or Michelle or anybody else on this program could possibly say about this war.
Yes, sir.
It's a terrible thing. It's something that, unfortunately, as you know, is happening with increasing regularity. There are something close to, we believe, on the basis of the latest reported U.S. casualties here as of today, including the incident of which your caller spoke, close to 90 American soldiers have been killed this month. It's pushing up to 2,800 American soldiers who've been killed in the course of the war, and, of course, many multiples of that who've been wounded. And I have to say that in terms of the morale of the American forces here, the astonishing thing is, badly as these losses are felt by every soldier and every unit that suffers them, and we've all of us correspondents here seen these incidents occur and seen the memorial services that are held afterwards and the bodies that are loaded with the grave ceremony onto helicopters and flown back on the first leg of their journey home. Despite this, what we find is that the morale in American military units remains, on the whole, remarkably high. And I want to say one other thing about that, and that is that whilst many of the big things are going wrong, even disastrously wrong here, many of the small things, the smaller things that the American military is attempting to do here go extremely well. If you're embedded with an American military unit, as I was for a day last week in western Baghdad, in one of the most strife-torn areas of western Baghdad, you see, in the course of even a matter of hours, a succession of acts of kindness, of interventions by American soldiers at every level, at every rank, that make a real difference. And my sense is that if this ends, as it ever seems ever more likely to do, in as a tragedy rather than a success, I do believe that many Iraqis, remembering what Americans did here, will still overall have very positive memories of individual American military, of their individual interactions with the American armed forces and with American soldiers.
Michel Flournoy in Washington. So here we are. We salute that morale that the American troops keep up. It's incredible, and even the kindnesses that John Burns points to. But nobody, we hear Renata's families, the hit it's taken, nobody wants those troops to be sent into a strategy that's not working. There's a lot of talk about change now in Washington, also talk that the choices are all ugly. What appear to be the major alternatives on the table or near it at this point?
Well, I would agree that, you know, we are stuck with a range of bad choices. I have a colleague here who likes to say, once you drive your car off the cliff, your options narrow substantially. Mm-hmm. And we are in that midair trying to figure out what to do. That said, I worry that this debate between stay the course and cut and run is really a false one. That's not doing justice to the American people.
It seems like we're getting past that debate right now.
Well, I hope we are.
So what do the rungs on this ugly ladder look like? What are the options?
Yeah, we definitely need a change in strategy, and I think that change in strategy needs to have the following components. First and foremost, this we have to focus on negotiating the political solution to Iraq.
What does that mean?
What that means is pressuring not only the United States, because we can't do it alone, but bringing in the constructive countries in the region, the Saudis, for example, and others, to pressure their respective friends inside of Iraq to go back to the negotiating table, to buy into the government and to the political process, as opposed to trying to settle their problems via violence.
Giving the killing and cycle of violence inside Iraq now, is Iraq really susceptible to that kind of string pulling from outside, American, Saudi, even Iranian?
I don't think it's string pulling as much. All of these different factions have outside supporters in terms of funders, in terms of people they look to as protectors, advisors, suppliers. And though they have, whether we like it or not, those outside powers have influence. we need to be rounding up all of those influencers, whether we like them or whether we don't. And this includes people like countries like Iran and Syria, who thus far we haven't engaged very heavily. But to engage them deeply, to say, look, we are looking at right now the potential not only of an Iraqi civil war, but if it really becomes a civil war, a war that becomes a regional war. And none of us want that. None of us sees that as in our interest. So what do we do collectively to keep the lid on this and to push the Iraqi parties to get back to the political negotiating table? I think that is absolutely critical. And I don't care what we do with our military forces. If you do not have that political component as the centerpiece of your strategy, we cannot stabilize the situation.
Michelle, hold that thought. I want to ask about timetables as well, but for a kind of reality check, John Burns, political negotiation here, job one, Michelle Flournoy says, and get the neighbors involved in that. Do you see an Iraq susceptible to that? If we get Iran, Syria, the Saudis, and the U.S. pushing for that, does that mean it's more likely to happen? Do they have that kind of traction or clout there?
I think Michelle knows a lot more about these things than I do, but I can only say that it's very difficult to imagine President Ahmadinejad of Iran, just to take one example, considering the kind of speeches he has been making about wiping Israel off the map, doing anything that's helpful to the United States in trying to stabilize the situation here. It's ironic, of course, because the United States, with its democratic plan here, has in effect brought to power for the first time for generations a Shiite-led government. You would think that Iran would have some interest in stabilizing that government, but all the indications are that Iran appears to be, as much as it supports some of the Iraqi parties, it seems to be more concerned with creating trouble for the United States.
But what about the threat of region? What about regional war, John Burns? Is that not an ominous threat to Tehran as well as others there?
You would think so, wouldn't you, that a civil war in Iraq would be a disaster for all of the nations in the region and that they would get involved now on a timely basis to help try and prevent it. But it's not for the want of trying by the United States, other than, of course, its unwillingness to talk directly to the government of Iran. They simply haven't had that kind of support, not from the Sunni Arab nations to the west, the north, and the south of Iraq, and certainly not from Iran. It seems to me that when we're talking about what, if anything, would fix this, the first thing that's going to have to happen is you're going to have to get on top of the sectarian violence in Iraq. And to do that, you're going to need, above all, an effective security policy, and that means enough troops. The Americans do not have enough Iraqi troops fighting alongside them to secure Baghdad, much less other areas of the country where the sectarian violence is erupting. What are they going to do about that in the short term? I have an ominous feeling that one of the things under consideration may be to intensify the American troop presence in Baghdad, and how they might do that. Will they draw American troops into Baghdad? They've already doubled the troop presence here in the last 12 weeks. Will they bring American troops into Baghdad from other areas outside Baghdad, exposing them to more of the sectarian violence? Or will they, God bless the troops involved, extend the locations of some of the troops already here?
John, hold that thought, Michelle Flournoy. How do you look at this issue? I mean, two things here. One, troop strength. John McCain says bring in more American troops. John Burns says you're going to have more troops of some kind in Baghdad. American generals are saying this is it. This is our last chance here to get a handle on this. And on the other side of that, what about the timetable? Without one, can the U.S. government really get Iraq's attention?
In Baghdad and the other four provinces that are giving us the most trouble, I agree that we need higher troop concentrations, at least initially, to stabilize the situation. And how do you accomplish that? If unfortunately McCain's idea of bringing in lots more troops from outside the country isn't really realistic, because there just aren't that many ready units left in the U.S. Army that are available for deployment, that have the people and the training and the equipment to actually come in a quick, in a timely manner. So I think what we're looking at is redeployment within the country, where we would ask Iraqi forces to do more of, take more of a leadership and more responsibility in relatively quiet and calm and or even somewhat dicey but not really terrible areas, so that we could bring more higher concentration of coalition troops into Baghdad and into the other, Al-Anbar and other provinces that are giving us trouble. But in addition to changing the troop numbers, we've got to make a fundamental shift in strategy towards counterinsurgency, where the focus shifts from not, seeking and destroying, but really the center of gravity becomes the population, protecting the population, providing for the needs of the population, and in so doing, marginalizing the insurgents and the terrorists from their base of support.
But we've heard that for years now, and it appears from a distance.
We haven't actually done it on a consistent basis.
Are we capable? I mean, if we've been talking that line for all this time and haven't done it, does it mean we can't?
I think we are capable of it, but I think we've wasted a lot of valuable time, and it's going to be much more difficult to achieve now. All I'm saying is that just bringing in more troops isn't going to do it unless you also shift the emphasis.
Let me get a call from Charleston, South Carolina. Lauren is calling. Hi, Lauren. You're on the air.
Hi. Actually, you just addressed what I was talking about. I was against the war from the very beginning. I pulled into Sonic right when you answered. I'm sorry.
You're at the gas station filling up. Maybe the oil came from there. So what now? More troops? Fewer? Get out?
Well, I think we have a moral obligation. I'm totally against war, I think. But now that we're there, we have to be there. And I keep hearing, for a civil war to happen, it would be in Iran's, not in their interest, and I don't see why it wouldn't be in their interest.
Lauren, let us pick all that up, and I want to go to the timetable issue. Michelle, the headlines this week say, this weekend, John Burns' paper, The Times, saying Washington's going to hand the Iraqi government a timetable and say, meet these benchmarks or you're on your own. A, do you see that actually happening, and B, do you think it's a good idea, necessary?
I do think that we need to clearly signal to the Iraqi government that, A, we're not going to be here forever, and, B, we need to see you doing more, and we're going to start handing off more as we can. I don't think we want to set an artificial mechanistic timetable that says no matter what the conditions are, this is going to happen on this date. But what we do need to do is break this growing dependency that we see. And we need to do that with some actions that says, okay, we're going to start by, even as we redeploy troops within the country, we're going to start bringing the overall numbers down. We're not going to abandon you, but we're not going to be here forever. We're not going to have permanent bases, and we need to clearly signal that to the Iraqi people, because that is not a fact that has been made clear, and the terrorists and the insurgents use that against us on a daily basis. But we need to very clearly push the Iraqi government and the Iraqi security forces, now that there are substantial numbers trained, to step up to the plate and do more. That will require us to continue to work with them in small military training and advising teams embedded with those units.
Yep. Let me pick this point up with John, if I may. John Burns, in Baghdad, where do you see U.S. leverage with the Iraqi government here? Would a timetable rally that government around, getting a lid on the militias, around sharing resources, working together, making this thing work politically?
I have to say, having watched the political process here unfolding since American troops arrived in April 2003, I think I and many others like myself here would be very doubtful that any deadlines would have any effect. Every deadline that has been set in this entire process has either been missed or fudged in some way. All the big issues have been punted, moved down the line, and now, of course, what you've got is the clock running down in Washington, D.C. I just don't think that the United States has the partners here, either politically or, sadly, militarily, to make this thing work, and that insofar as a further descent into chaos can be prevented, it's going to depend primarily on United States military power here. It's a really tragic situation. Let me say, of course, there are Iraqi units that are fighting well, but many others are deeply infiltrated. I heard only today that in Diyala province, northeast of Baghdad, American commanders are coming to the conclusion that both the army and the police there, at the very highest level, Iraqi army and police, have in fact been involved with death squads.
And there's the tough, tough report from Iraq. John Burns, Baghdad Bureau Chief for the New York Times, thank you very much for joining us. And Michelle Flournoy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, our thanks to you as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.